Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Hannah, and I'm very excited to be hosting What in the World, a new daily podcast from the BBC World Service, where we try to help you make sense of the world around you, of the big things that are happening, the small things that are happening, and everything in between. Search for What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 13th of August, these are our main stories. Disaster management officials are sending more resources to the Hawaiian island of Maui as the search for victims of deadly wildfires continues. A doctor has been given access to Niger's ousted president, who's been held prisoner in a basement since last month's coup. Saudi Arabia is appointing its first ambassador to the Palestinian Authority. Also in this podcast...
They speak of another time and another place. A stunning combination of pure commercialism and a kind of ageless beauty.
An exhibition showcases the neon signs of Hong Kong that used to light up the city's night sky, but many of which have now disappeared. Begin in Hawaii. Officials say 80 people have died in wildfires that have devastated the island of Maui. Hawaii's Attorney General has ordered an investigation into the handling of the fire as questions grow over whether the authorities could have done more to warn residents. Our correspondent John Sudworth sent this report from near the town of Lahaina, which has been ruined by the blaze.
More expert help is on its way to the town of Lahaina for the difficult task of combing through the charred embers for signs of human remains. Some homes and buildings have not yet been searched, and the authorities are warning that the number of confirmed deaths is likely to rise further still. Captain Vince Carter is a local helicopter pilot and has seen the devastation from the air.
There was a pit in your stomach knowing that this is just the tip of the spear, you know, losing buildings, losing property. Passing by the marina, you could see there was still boats on fire. Wooden slips at the docks were gone. So we're talking things that were floating on water, that it was so hot that those lit on fire.
While the forensic work continues, there's another major challenge: housing and feeding the thousands made homeless by the wildfire. Access into the town, which was almost completely destroyed earlier this week, is restricted to residents only, and there have been long tailbacks for those trying to return by car to retrieve what few belongings they can, even while firefighters continue to tackle flare-ups. Many are still searching for news of missing family members, an effort complicated by the still disrupted phone and power networks. While the mood remains calm here, there are hints of anger too, with questions about whether the authorities could have provided more warning of the impending disaster. A review of official decision-making has been announced by Hawaii's Attorney General.
The American Red Cross has set up emergency shelters on Maui. My colleague Lucy Gray spoke to its national spokesman, Todd James, and asked about the challenges they're facing.
The main focus of our work continues to be sheltering, working with our partners, the local and state government and our nonprofit partners in the area, because we've got to make sure that all of these families who have been displaced have a safe place to stay, have access to food, to medical care, to crisis counseling. And of course, you know, knowing that they've got a safe place to go and until they figure out what their next steps are. We've had thousands of people coming through the shelters. We've had over 2,900 overnight stays so far, and a lot of folks who are coming into the shelter during the day. They can charge their phones, they can get a meal, they can talk to some of the other partners we have in the shelters with us to get information. And if they need to stay, then they know they're more than welcome to stay with us. So that is our big focus right now. Once it's safe and we get the word from officials that we can begin going out, we'll assist with the damage assessment of the area, and then we'll start distributing some of the emergency supplies that families will need when they start the cleaning process.
And is it the case that some people haven't been reached yet? I mean, we're hearing that hundreds are thought to be uncontactable, they're unaccounted for. Does that mean that they haven't been reached?
You know, I haven't gotten any direct information. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some difficulties getting hold of some folks. You know, there's a lot of confusion. The infrastructure is down. The communications, electricity, water, all of that you know, is not functioning or barely working in some areas affected by the fire. So that makes it very tough. So I'm sure the officials are doing all they can. It's still a search and rescue operation. So that's why they're restricting access, I believe. But whoever needs shelter, if there are still folks out there and they make their way to our shelter, they're going to find a welcome arm from a Red Cross volunteer who will get them settled, get them a meal, and make sure they have access to everything they need right now.
Todd James of the American Red Cross. The family doctor of the ousted president of Niger, Mohamed Bazoum, has said he's in good spirits after visiting the deposed leader. Mr. Bazoum and his family have been held captive in the basement of the presidential palace since he was removed from office by the military last month. The doctor who brought them food and medicine said their living conditions were difficult. Here's Richard Hamilton.
The doctor's visit reportedly came as a huge relief to the president, his wife, and their 20-year-old son, who has a serious medical condition. Earlier, the UN Human Rights Chief, Volker Turk, said the conditions of their detention were inhumane, degrading, and in violation of international human rights law. But despite the widespread condemnation, the military junta continues to hold Mr. Bazoum, presumably as a hostage, to make West African leaders think twice about military intervention.
Armenia has called for the UN Security Council to hold an urgent meeting on the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia has accused neighbouring Azerbaijan of preventing supplies being delivered to the region. The enclave, which is landlocked within Azerbaijan but largely populated by ethnic Armenians, is only connected to Armenia by a single short mountain road. Armenia and Azerbaijan have fought two wars over the territory since the 1980s. The last in 2022 saw Azerbaijan make substantial territorial gains. Rebecca Kesby has been talking to Meher Margaryan, Armenia's ambassador to the UN, and asked him about the appeal to the Security Council.
We have been warning the international community that the alarming situation in Nagorno-Karabakh is close to turning into a humanitarian catastrophe for some months now. And the closure of this vital lifeline by Azerbaijan has been instigating conditions of a man-made humanitarian catastrophe. Today is exactly 8 months that thousands of besieged families in Nagorno-Karabakh have been suffering from critical shortages of essential goods, including food, fuel, and medical supplies. And we think that it is up to the Security Council to uphold its responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security and to take appropriate measures to prevent mass atrocities, including ethnic cleansing and the crime of genocide, from happening in Nagorno-Karabakh.
What can you tell us about the situation with Azerbaijan? I mean, have you asked them to reopen that road? Presumably you have.
Not only that, we have asked them. The International Court of Justice issued provisional measure in February and then one again reaffirmed in July, according to which Azerbaijan shall take all measures to ensure unimpeded movement of persons, vehicles and cargo along the Lachin corridor, which Azerbaijan is not implementing to this day. The Secretary General of the United Nations made three statements, one in December, the other one in February, and the most recent one on the 3rd of August, calling for the unconditional implementation of International Court of Justice's ruling and reaffirming the binding nature of that. Many international organizations called upon Azerbaijan to implement the court order. And we have appealed also to the Security Council a month ago, asking the Security Council specifically to undertake urgent and effective measures in response to Azerbaijan's violation of international humanitarian law and to ensure the implementation of legally binding orders of International Court of Justice. Nothing happened so far.
The BBC did approach the government of Azerbaijan for comments, but they didn't respond to us. French and British coast guards have rescued 58 people from a boat full of migrants that got into difficulty in the English Channel on Saturday. Six people are known to have died. Those rescued include children, most of them from Afghanistan and Sudan. Frank Dersin is vice president of the Hauts-de-France region on the French coast. He told us how difficult it is to police migrants who are determined to make the crossing.
Nothing can stop the will of migrants to pass. We can only slow it down. When they are on the boat, it's impossible to stop. We have to stop the people before they go inside the boat.
The Coast Guard has taken many of the survivors to Calais. Rebecca Kesby spoke to our correspondent Bethany Bell, who's in the French port, and asked her what the authorities think happened.
They're still trying to find that out. Many of the people who are well enough to speak to the authorities are being questioned at the moment to try and establish how they were out on this overcrowded boat in very windy conditions when, of course, it capsized. And an investigation has been launched at the moment to try and see how this tragedy took place.
I mean, hundreds of migrants do try to make this journey every day, but it's incredibly dangerous, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world, and the water, even in the summer, is very cold.
Extremely cold, and as you say, an extremely busy area. 600 tankers, 200 ferries all around about passing every day. And, you know, difficult currents. Last night, the winds were strong, and France's Secretary of State for the Sea, responsible for safety at sea, was saying that the traffickers didn't seem to care about sending people out in a small dinghy in such conditions. And it was very distressing scenes there that we've seen.
And briefly, we heard there a French voice from the authorities. This is a political issue on both sides of the channel. But in the UK, the rules have changed recently, which is leading to quite a lot of controversy.
Well, the aid groups that we've been speaking to here in Calais say that they do warn migrants about the problems, the risks of trying to make this crossing and what awaits them on the other side. But many of them, as we heard just there, say they can't stop them. If people are determined to try and get over, it's very, very difficult to stop it. And one of the interesting things that we've been told is that it does seem that more migrants have been coming to this region in recent weeks. They're living rough along the shores. Hopes possibly that now that the summer weather has come, it might be easier to make the crossing, but certainly an uptick in numbers.
Our correspondent Bethany Bell in Calais. The authorities in the Czech Republic have appealed for calm after a teenage girl was raped and left for dead, allegedly by an 18-year-old Ukrainian man. Here's Rob Cameron.
Tuesday's shocking rape and attempted murder in the city of Plzeň has been condemned by both Czech and Ukrainian politicians, including Ukraine's deputy foreign minister, who was until recently ambassador to Prague. The girl, aged around 15, reportedly knew her alleged attacker and agreed to go for an evening walk with him. Police say she was then tied up, blindfolded, raped, stabbed, placed in a sack and pushed down a slope. She played dead before managing to free herself.
Now, for decades, they were a visual symbol of Hong Kong, the neon signs that lit up the city's night sky. In recent years, many of them have disappeared, thanks in part to safety concerns and worries about the environment. Now, a new exhibition is showcasing them in all their glory. Tim Allman reports.
They speak of another time and another place. A stunning combination of pure commercialism and a kind of ageless beauty. The signs represented all that was unique and magical about Hong Kong, literally illuminating, inspiring, and iconic. They are an increasingly rare species these days, but there are still people like Cardin Chan who want to restore them and show them off.
It's not only about the appreciation of the beauty of the signs up close, it's also about to understand the scale and then also the works that goes into each of these signs.
This exhibition shines a light on Hong Kong's cultural history, an opportunity for some to see a world they never knew and for some to relive their past. It's really worth recommending to others, said this visitor. It's conserving the history of Hong Kong. We saw these signs when we were young, but as time goes by, many of them disappear. Not so far away, another neon sign is taken down. Advertising a Kowloon restaurant, it's been in place for nearly 60 years. The owners say they've asked for permission to erect a new, smaller sign. But a chapter is closing for Hong Kong. In so many ways, the lights are going out.
Tim Allman reporting. Still to come, we'll meet the scientist who wanted to save a bit of his favourite glacier in Switzerland.
And I thought, now is the time to go up there one last time and save a bit of this ice.
World Football at the Women's World Cup is the podcast telling the global story of the tournament.
I'm so proud of our team, of our girls.
We're speaking to the fans who have travelled down under as they share all the excitement of this incredible competition.
Up my God!
I think we're still in the running to go all the way.
I'm really, really proud of Vietnamese.
This is probably the biggest moment in their careers and Australia's right behind them.
World Football at the Women's World Cup from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Saudi Arabia has named its first non-resident ambassador for the Palestinian territories. The move follows growing speculation that Saudi Arabia and Israel could soon reach an agreement to normalise relations. Here's our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
Saudi Arabia has long maintained that the normalisation of relations with Israel, which it currently does not recognise, is dependent on the establishment of a Palestinian state. So talk that the country could soon normalise relations without this will have alarmed many Palestinians. It appears that creating this new ambassadorial position, which also includes the role of Consul General to Jerusalem, is designed to show that Riyadh wouldn't abandon its support for the Palestinian cause. The new job is to be filled by the kingdom's ambassador to Jordan, Nayef al-Sudairi.
According to the conservation organisation WWF, or the Worldwide Fund for Nature, there are around 415,000 African elephants left in the world and a maximum of 50,000 Asian elephants. Some estimates suggest the populations have halved in 50 years because of ivory poaching in Africa and habitat loss in Asia. A decade ago, animal campaigners set up World Elephant Day on the 12th of August to highlight the plight of elephants around the world. This year, they're focusing on Asian elephants in particular, as our environment correspondent Navin Singh Kadka has been telling me.
Unlike with African elephants, the issue with these elephants is that, you know, they are now deprived of their habitat because, you know, forests are shrinking. And then that is why they come in contact with humans and there is conflict, retaliatory killing, as it is known. And then also, you know, not to forget the infrastructure building across all these countries, roads, railways, bridges, canals, obstruct their migratory paths. And finally, the tourism industry or even mining, you know, elephants are used in all those activities. That's why these animals, they are still so endangered.
So lots of ways in which mankind is getting in the way of the elephants. What about what governments are doing to try and stop this decline?
We don't see very much good stories. One example often quoted is in Myanmar, they identified 170,000 square kilometers for elephants. But then what they also found later on by an independent investigation was only 7% of that 170,000 square kilometers of habitat was protected.
How does this play out in India and Nepal, parts of the world that you know so well?
We all know about Assam tea, for example. So I went to this Assam tea states. We found these tea states were actually spreading, you know, right on where the traditional elephants' migratory routes are. So now what they find is instead of their forests or water holes, they find tea. And tea is something elephants don't eat. And they're very angry about it. And that's why what happens is elephants get into villages, kill people, and then people in turn kill elephants. That story is being played out not just in Bhutan or India, but also in Nepal and elsewhere. And then if you look at India's social media, we'll see trains knocking off elephants, even calves being killed on tracks. We need to identify where are those traditional migratory routes and then think about the solutions that you could dovetail with your development plans. Otherwise, what happens is elephants will keep on getting angry, seeing those tea states or palm oil forests or rubber plantations instead of their natural forests.
Our environment correspondent, Navin Singh Kadka. Now to football, and we know the four teams still in contention to win the Women's World Cup. The co-hosts Australia survived a tense penalty shootout to defeat France. England came from behind to beat Colombia. Our correspondent in Sydney, Shaima Halil, watched the day's action.
I think I've aged 10 years and almost lost my voice in those two matches. The good news is this has been one of the most entertaining, exciting, nerve-wracking days of the whole tournament. First off, let's start with Australia versus France. It was neck and neck until the very last minute, and that penalty shootout, there was just collective gasps and intakes of breath with every hit and miss. And then on to the England-Colombia game, and we all knew that this wasn't going to be an easy game. Colombia, this underdog of a team, have delivered some of the most dramatic and memorable moments. But I must say, kudos to England's defense. Kudos to that team that just kept running and running. And of course, these two goals from Lauren Hemp to equalize with Colombia, and then the winning goal from Alicia Russo. I think they delivered the win that so many fans have wanted. And I will tell you right now, I'm calling it, a Lionesses versus the Matildas game is going to break so many records in terms of viewership. I understand that 4,000 England fans have traveled for the World Cup. Some of them wanted tickets and they couldn't have them. So the next best thing is that they came to the fan zone. And I think what's really interesting is the confidence that they have in the team, that even though they were quite nervous about how they performed against Nigeria, every time I ask someone about how they felt about the Lionesses, they just said, we're confident. The rivalry is going to be there. But I will say this, I think the atmosphere is going to be electric. I think on the pitch, they both have a point to prove. Both teams know that they're a couple of steps away from making history for their country and their squads. So it is going to be a very strong game. I think it's going to get really, really physical. But I think off the pitch, it's going to be very, very enjoyable. And I think maybe I'll age another 10 years watching that game.
Our correspondent, Shaima Halil. Let's hear from some fans now. Here's the reaction of some Australia supporters watching in Sydney.
Oh, my God, best night of my life. My jersey's somewhere. My jersey's somewhere.
And here's England fan Jessica, who watched the game in her hometown of Doncaster.
It's amazing. I'm so happy with the way that they've played and they've been pushing through, and that's all they can do is hold their own and push to the next round. And that's the most important thing. That it's amazing also for young players to look up to these players and know that it's possible to make it there and that the women's game is just growing every year. So it was awesome.
The first of the two semi-finals on Tuesday between Sweden and Spain. Let's stay with football. He's the captain of the English team, the country's record goal scorer, but Harry Kane's first night playing in the German Bundesliga certainly hasn't gone to plan. Brought on as a replacement striker on Saturday, the day he signed for Bayern Munich, they then lost the German Super Cup final to RB Leipzig. I've been talking to Joe Inwood, who spent the day outside the stadium in Munich, so not the dream start that Harry Kane might have wanted.
No, but I think it probably would have been too good to be true had he come on and brought Bayern down back from 2-0 down to RB Leipzig. The truth is, he didn't get much of a touch of the ball. He came on in about the 60th minute or so. He ran around gamely, but I think it was beyond even a man of his prodigious talents. I mean, it's worth pointing out, Harry Kane wouldn't have even had a chance to train properly with his new teammates. In the end, they lost 3-0, so Harry Kane's 19-year wait for silverware continues, at least for this day, probably until the end of the season.
Harry Kane's been at Tottenham Hotspur, the English Premier League club, for 20 years. He is, as I said, the England captain, record goal scorer. Why does he want to go and play in Germany?
A number of reasons. I mean, firstly, it's a lovely country to be in, to live in. It's beautiful city that he has here in Munich. But I think in terms of the football, he's got some great clubs. Bayern is a fantastic side, obviously a great international reputation, highest quality football, but also very well run. It's one of the things that's commonly said about German clubs is they don't overspend. He is indeed the most expensive player any German club's ever bought. And I think they know it's going to be a well-run team. But more than that, the reason Harry Kane wanted to come here is to win trophies. And it's worth, you know, this cup, the Super Cup that they didn't win today, they've won for 6 of the 7 previous seasons. They've won more than 10 Bundesligas in a row. So I think it probably would be assumed that he will win trophies if he comes here, even if he didn't do it today.
Joe Inwood in Munich. Campaigners in Britain have raised concerns that betting firms are targeting adverts at players of the online game Fantasy Premier League, or FPL, which is popular with children. Millions of people around the world play FPL. What you have to do is pick a team of footballers and then you earn points based on their real-life performance. Anyone over 13 can play. As a result, it's a target for the global gambling industry recruiting their next generation of customers. Rob Wayne is an FPL content creator.
I cannot think of many
major Fantasy Premier League websites that do not advertise gambling or have some form of affiliation with a gambling company or a subsidiary of a gambling company. And those major websites have signed pretty much every major content creator of Fantasy Football and Fantasy Premier League.
Tom Grundy, tell me more about the game.
It's huge. I think last year, 11 million people signed up in total, and just under half of those were in the UK. So that's an awful lot of people around the world. But there's also this huge subculture community that's grown up around it as well, made up of independent websites, not affiliated to the Premier League, content creators with thousands of followers, all making a living based on sharing tools and tips to do with FPL. And that seems to be where these betting companies are trying to find a way in.
We know how big the English Premier League is with our listeners all over the world on the World Service, particularly with the biggest clubs. Gambling is clearly part of football. It's just suddenly becoming part of this app.
Yeah, basically, we've got these independent sites and people are telling me that the betting community have probably seen similarities between the game Fantasy Premier League. It's played by predominantly young men who are clearly interested in sport. And that ticks a lot of the same boxes as people who do traditional sports betting as well. And certainly some of the charities we've been speaking to, one of which led on the campaign to get betting ads off Premier League football shirts, they think that the betting industry see FPL as fertile ground, basically, for the next generation of customers and potentially addicts.
And there are different rules governing gambling, especially gambling with any sense of targeting people under 18 in different countries. But when something's being played internationally, you can get around all that.
Yeah, and that's the thing with perhaps a content creator sending a tweet, for example, that's promoted by a betting company. Certain people in certain jurisdictions around the world are going to be seeing that where potentially gambling's illegal. And actually, fantasy sports has a really interesting relationship with gambling regulation around the world. One of the big companies that we've seen sponsoring stuff around FPL is DraftKings. And they're one of the biggest gambling companies in the US. The reason that they became so big is because there was such tight gambling regulation in certain states in the US that actually paid fantasy sports with prizes and in a sort of fantasy format was seen as a way of getting round and getting across these tight gambling rules. And even though they've been lessened in states now, companies like DraftKings and FanDuel are still huge and have a huge market share.
Joe Grundy reporting. Switzerland is known for its snowy peaks and skyscraping alpine glaciers. But just like glaciers all over the world, warmer global temperatures are seeing them start to melt away. One glacial scientist, Matthias Huss, decided to save the last bit of his favourite glacier, and it's in his own freezer. Matthias is a senior researcher at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich and has been talking to Rebecca Casby.
This Pitol Glacier is a very small glacier in Switzerland. It has been studied since more than 100 years. And since 18 years, at the beginning of my PhD, I went up there to look at it in more detail, doing measurements on this glacier at least twice a year. And it has strongly declined in area and thickness. And it has now almost completely disappeared.
How did you know that it was going to disappear?
Well, it became thinner and thinner, and then about 4 years ago, it started to fall apart. So different pieces of it split off, and more rocks started to protrude out of the ice. So it all went very, very fast in the last few years. So in 2022, after this extreme melting event of that summer, I needed to stop the measurements. And now there was just this little tiny piece of ice left that I knew it was still old glacier ice, but just basically a few square meters. And I thought, well, now it's a time to go up there one last time and save a bit of this ice. I put it in my own freezer for the moment. I will probably put it at ETH later to the university. But it's not for a scientific reason. So it's not for scientific analysis, but it's really just for emotional reasons. It's to save this little part of my baby glacier that I'm very attached onto, because obviously climate change will put a complete end to this ice this year, probably maybe next year, but then it's over.
I mean, you say it's not for scientific research, but we do know that glacial ice does contain history, doesn't it, in its own way, which may be useful scientifically?
Yes, exactly. So one can analyze glacier ice in very much detail, but this is not feasible for these glaciers at low or relatively low elevation that are so small. So if you go to Antarctica or to Greenland or at the very high elevation of the Alps, then you can actually analyze the history of the Earth's climate out of the glacier ice. But as I said, this is for the bigger ice masses and it's much more demanding than what I did here.
The glacial scientist Matthias Huss in Switzerland. And that's it from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on Twitter, we are @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.